It's time for From the Shortgrass, presented by UAMS Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine with Cray Schapp. A golf podcast for those who love golf, struggle with golf, and just like to enjoy the outdoors and fellowship with friends, all while chasing a ball around, trying to put it in a 4 1/4-inch diameter hole. From the Shortgrass is presented by UAMS Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine and brought to you by Stevens Incorporated, an independent financial services firm with the freedom to focus on what matters most. And now, from the Shortgrass, here's your host, Cray Schapp.
Welcome to another edition of From the Shortgrass, presented by UAMS Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. I am your host, Cray Schapp. Remember, UAMS Ortho Now is now open at the Orthopedic and Spine Hospital at UAMS Health. If you have an orthopedic injury, sports, work, or anything else, walk in and see the best in orthopedic care. You don't need an appointment. Ortho Now, open Monday through Friday, 8 to 8, and Saturday, 8 to noon. It's conveniently located at the Orthopedic and Spine Hospital at UAMS Health. For more information, call 501-686-TOSH. That's 501-686-8674. Coming up after the break, I sit down with Connor Lewis for part one of two From the Shortgrass episodes. Connor produces a weekly newsletter called The Society of Golf Historians. Each week you get an email delivered to your inbox that has the newsletter attached to it. Now, these newsletters go really deep into golf history. If you are someone that really loves the history of the game of golf, this is a must for you. You need to sign up for the Society of Golf Historians newsletter. How do you do that? You go to thesocietyofgolfhistorians.beehive.com. That's BEEHIIV.com. Now, Connor is all over social media. You can follow him on X at S Historians. You can follow him on Instagram at the Society of Golf Historians. And of course, find him on Facebook as well, the Society of Golf Historians. Every week, you get a relevant golf history story in your inbox. It's a digital and community platform founded in 2018 by Connor Lewis, dedicated to researching, preserving, and sharing the rich traditions and stories of golf history. Coming up after the break, I'm going to sit down for part one of my interview with Connor Lewis. Stay with us.
Strength is measured not by the number of accounts. Strength is placing value on relationships. It's having the vision and the guts to invest in growth. It's the commitment to responsibly manage your money. At Stevens, we believe that our strengths build success, not only for us, but for our clients. Stevens, member NYSE, SIPC.
This is Justin Akery. If shoulder or elbow pain is affecting your daily life, the fellowship-trained physicians at the Orthopedic and Spine Hospital at UAMS Health are here to help. They offer advanced care for injuries, arthritis, rotator cuff problems, and more, helping you feel better, move better, and get back to everyday life. Call 501-686-TOSH today to schedule your appointment. That's 501-686-8674. The doctor will see you now.
Welcome back to this edition of From the Shortgrass, presented by UAMS Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. I am your host, Cray Schapp. If this is your first time listening to From the Shortgrass, I invite you to go back through our archives and listen to some of the other episodes with some of the interesting guests that I've been able to have on. Everybody that plays the game has a story. You have a story. Everyone has a story about how they got started playing the game of golf. I try to bring that out in this podcast. One of those guys that has an interesting story about how he got started playing the game, but not just playing the game, but diving deep into its history, is Connor Lewis, the Society of Golf Historians. Part one of my sit down with Connor is now on the tee, Connor Lewis. Connor, thanks for joining me for this edition of From the Shortgrass. Do you remember the first time you ever picked up a golf club and fell in love with this game?
Wow. I mean, those are probably two different things.
I can remember the first time I picked it up and hated the game.
Yeah.
I picked up the game really late. Gosh, I'm trying to think how old I mean, it was after college. I
was really?
Probably close to like 25. It might be past that. I mean, I'm probably only 20 some years into playing golf, 25. And my brother bought me a set of, we were just talking about this today, weirdly enough, Cleveland. I can't remember that, you know, the name of the iron, but it was the black, like Clevelands. They were like really cool looking. And he bought me these irons to play golf. And we went out to, I think our first round was Airport National in Iowa. One of the greatest names. I really want to redesign their logo, like with a Orville and Wright, like plane or something, or a biplane. But went out there. I remember not playing well, but the fondest bad memory I have of golf is playing Pleasant Valley in Iowa City, Iowa. It was my dad, my brother. They knew I was going to be terrible. They'd been playing for a little while. So they bought me, I think I had 30 golf balls. And some of them might have been range balls, to be honest. And we went out and I'd say 14 holes in, I no longer had any balls and they wouldn't let me have any.
You were done?
I mean, it's just terrible. I lost a ball like on every hole, like more clearly. I had 30 balls.
Yeah.
And I was not liking the game. And then I don't recall that moment that it hit the heartstrings, but it probably wasn't that long after that. And then, you know, you fall in love with this game and then you're stuck for life. And then, you know, loving history, then it got worse for me.
I was going to say, because you seem to me like a guy in reading some of your posts on history, the Society of Golf Historians, the newsletter that comes out weekly.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Every Tuesday. Seems to me like you would be someone that, okay, grew up playing this game. Yeah. I'm surprised to learn that you picked it up after college.
Crazy late. Crazy late. I belong to, there is no definitive proof on what is the oldest course west of the Mississippi, despite what seven different clubs will tell you. But the date most likely was 1892. And I belonged to a club in Iowa, Fairfield Golf and Country Club, growing up, that was one of those 1892 courses.
But you didn't play.
I did not play. I was on the swim team. My dad played. I think my mom played for a little bit. And she stopped playing because maybe the pro told her that she swung or looked like a frog when she was swinging. So she quit. And it was just my dad, right, that played. None of us played golf. We were all on the swim team. And then we moved to Iowa City right before you know, high school started. And golf was not a thing. And I'll say this. I tell people all the time, I'm as much as anybody probably a product of Tiger Woods making the game cool. And, you know, I'd always loved history. I was much more into baseball, football, sports like that, but not golf. And then, you know, first two times I played golf, I don't know if I had the heartstrings thing because I think I sucked that bad. But then something happened. You know, you hit that one shot and you're hooked.
I was going to say, what happened? Because losing 30 balls your first time out, I would think that, okay, I'm not going to try this ever again. But for some reason, you did.
Yeah. You know, I played for a little while really badly. We moved to Portland. My wife now, I guess she would have been my girlfriend then. We moved to Boise, Idaho. And I was thinking about starting to play golf about that time. I think I had the set for a little while. I started playing gradually, not playing well. Now, I'm a really fast player. I'm a single digit now. But I started playing really fast. Then we moved to Oregon shortly after that, and I played even faster. But I was so worried about being the slow player that I don't even have a practice swing. Like, I try to force myself now to have a practice swing, specifically on touch shots, which is where I really need them. But, like, full swing, I'm super fast. If left to my own device, which often I am when I go play early in the morning, I play 18 holes in 2 hours and 5 minutes, right around the 2 hours.
That's moving.
And that's shooting. My last round was a 73. So, like, moving and playing pretty well. But I remember really having to get good at golf when I went to go play my future in-laws. So it was Mike Tully, Joe Tully, and Pat Tully. So the two latter ones are my brother-in-laws. And we played at Rockford Country Club. I'm a real hack at this point. I'm better. I'm not losing golf balls, but I don't know. I probably didn't have a handicap at the time, but let's call it a 22, 23 handicap. And they beat me by like 30 strokes. Like, it was really bad. And I came in depressed. And I think we had just moved to Portland, Oregon at the time. And I said to my wife, you know, I'm either going to get good at this game or I'm never going to play it. So every day after work, I would go to the range. No instruction, mind you. The only thing I remember was like trying to think of my arms as a triangle and maintaining that. I don't know if I even think about that anymore, but you know, just trying to find something in there to where I could have some level of control. And then, you know, I graduated. I remember breaking 90 for the first time in Portland. And I remember getting to a point where I felt like, you know, again, I probably didn't have a handicap at the time, but I'd probably get down to like 14, 15, somewhere around there. And we left Portland to move back to the Midwest to raise a family. And I met Larry Gladson, who was the pro at Elmcrest Country Club, who was coincidentally the club that Zach Johnson grew up playing at. I don't know. I would tell people amateurs, like, you know, the thing that really took me from like a 12 to a 5 was probably stop hitting full swings with wedges. And so I just learned to start hitting 3/8, and then I started chipping better and putting better, and the rest is kind of history.
When did you really start to concentrate on the game? Then?
Yeah, that embarrassment. You know, I think you learn a lot early on when you're playing the game that magazines aren't as prevalent as they are.
Once were.
Right. Now, I guess YouTube's probably taken that place. But what you realize is the advice that you'd get in like the Golf Magazine, the Golf Digest, was built for a specific problem. Like the fix was. So you do it and you might have, you know, the opposite problem. It makes you worse, even if you're doing it correctly. So I learned that kind of quick. And then I think it was trial and error in Portland. And then Larry Gladson, I credit him as one of being one of the greatest golf professionals of all time. Because he was one of those guys, I would say a good golf professional, when you finish getting a lesson from a great golf professional, you will play better golf. Like if you end and you're worse, I don't know if that was a good lesson for you. And so like Larry helped take me to that next level. And then I got crazy and started playing hickory shafted clubs and lost my mind.
Why would you go to the hickory shafted clubs?
You know, it was late 2007. I was going to take my dad to Scotland for his 65th birthday in 2008. And I went to, I'm living in Iowa at the time. And, you know, it's, let's call it January, December, January, somewhere around there. And back then, if you wanted to hit balls, this is pre-simulators. They had a golf dome in Des Moines, and it was about 2 hours away from my house. And I was like, all right, I'm going to go play TPC Sawgrass. You know, at the start off the season, we're going to play Scotland later that summer. So I was like, I need to get my swing going. So I drive to this dome, this golf dome. It probably had a carry of like 50 yards. And I get to this dome. It was funny because it was the end of the year season, like pro shop sales. All the dumb stuff that people had ordered that nobody wanted, like neon pink and orange polo shirts. I walk in there and instantly I am depressed because I see they're using like half the range is full of just the junk drawer of things that nobody would buy. And I didn't know that going in. I just traveled 2 hours to get there on ice. And I walk in and I see these two lunatics, Russ Fisher and Bill Reed in the corner, wearing knickers, newsboy caps. You know, they're older guys, but like probably as old as I am right now. But back then, they you know, seemed like older guys. And they have all these hickory shafted clubs. And as like a lover of golf history, or not golf history at the time, but just history, I was like, well, let me go check them out. So I'm checking them out. And the craftsmanship of these wooden shafted clubs is just remarkable. I'm looking at them. I'm admiring them. And Russ said, hey, do you want to go over the range and hit some of these hickory shafted clubs? And I said the same thing that every single human being has said of this era that has ever done it, I'll break one. And his response was like, Connor, these shafts and clubs have been put together for 100 years. They've seen far worse players than you.
They're not going to break.
And yeah, if they do, we won't charge you anything for it. So I go over there and I remember I had some Walter Hagen irons. I think I had a Walter Hagen hickory shafted wood. And I just started hitting really good shots with it. And it felt good, right? There was something about it. And something psychotic clicked in my brain where I decided that there was zero chance that I could play golf without owning a hickory shafted set.
Really?
And so it's like kind of the historian in me is like, how can I ever really talk about Bobby Jones, Walter Hagen, if I've never actually played the equipment they've played, right? Like, what kind of opinion can I form if I've never swung on those shoes or at those shafts in this case? Yeah, I went to TPC Sawgrass, hickory shafted clubs, never playing them before. And they were Tom Stewart RTJs, which were the exact duplicates of the irons Bobby Jones used in his prime. So he had a set made by Tom Stewart. Tom Stewart perhaps illegally made molds of those clubs and would sell them with his initials on them, Robert Tyre Jones, RTJ. And famously, RTJ is said to have written a cease and desist because he didn't want to lose his amateur status. So there's very few of these sets. You know, I told Russ and Bill, I'm like, listen, what's the greatest set of hickory shafted clubs? They mentioned RTJs, and they're like, you're never going to find them. And I was like, well, I have to have them now. And I tracked them down, got them in a month. They were in playable shape, took them to TPC Sawgrass, never played hickories before, mind you. And I shot an 84. And I was like, oh, we're in trouble. Like, if I can shoot like that, like, why would I play modern clubs? And so that's what I had in my bag. This was 2008. So that's a semi-early adopter in the world of hickory shafted clubs. There were guys, you know, playing hickory shafted clubs back then, but probably not as many as we have now. And took him to Scotland and played, you know, the whole trip with just hickory shafted club shot. I think I shot a 79 at the Old Course.
There you go.
And for 7 years, I only played hickory shafted clubs. And the last two of those, I really went overboard and we played, I played gutty clubs, which is a level of insanity that cannot be expressed. It's clubs from the 1800s with a gutta percha golf ball. Mind you, if I am swinging really well with a modern golf ball, you know, I'm hitting the ball, you know, 290, sometimes 300, depending on conditions, maybe wind. And with a hickory shafted driver, now, mind you, this is years ago. I don't play a lot now, but I could hit the ball 260, 270 if I was hitting it really well. With gutty clubs, long nose driver, gutta percha club, I could hit the ball 190 yards. So it changes golf courses. Back then, golf courses were like 5,000 yards long. The par didn't exist.
Yeah.
So for 2 years, I just played gutty golf, which is a level. Like I said, what I tell people, and I think this is a great description of how much the game has changed. You see this sometimes when I get into a debate on Twitter, is that there is a larger discrepancy from 1899 to 1905 than there is from 1905 to today. That 10-year period set up modern golf forever. It's the largest change in the history of our game happened in that 10-year period because of the golf ball.
And it changed so much, so drastically and quickly.
Everything we know about golf, the golden age of golf design, the precipice of that, the beginning of it, the origin story is the wound ball, the Haskell ball. And because overnight, golfers picked up 40 to 50 yards on their drives because of this wound ball that's rubber bands, you know, if people played in the 1980s, sometimes 90s. We picked up such a large distance that all of these golf courses, like Marion, you saw the Marion wicker basket in the office, they had to move property. They had to move courses because their old courses were Victorian. They were too short. They didn't have the land to expand. And they moved to the East and West course that they have now, I believe in Ardmore. Oakmont was perhaps the first golf course built for a modern golf ball and was pushing, it wasn't 7,000 yards, but it was close. It was a par of 80. And again, I think that's more of an understanding of what is par in this new era of this long ball. National Golf Links of America. I mean, all these amazing golf courses started with that.
When did you, Connor, really start diving into history? And does that come from being a history buff?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. I think my love for history starts with my dad. So my dad's a dentist. His dad was a dentist. My dad had a moment in his 40s. He had what I think we'd call midlife crisis. And he decided that he hated dentistry. And he was on the verge of giving it up to become a history teacher. He always loved history. And I think somehow that bled into my brain. And so, you know, I've always loved history. I've loved historical stories. If you look at my podcast list, there's some golf, but I really like historical stories, whether it's wars, whatever, you know, anything like that. I'm always fascinated. And so I think I was interested in golf history when I started playing, you know, in the 2000s, early 2000s. But what I think really pushed me over that edge was that 2008 decision to move to hickories. Because then it was like, all right, I like golf history. I'm learning about golf history. Now I'm, you know, in a way playing golf history. Like I really need to absorb it. And what I found out is I'm terrible with names. But when it comes to something like golf history, for whatever reason, if I read it, it sticks. I was like Cliff Clavin.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm like a Cliff Clavin for golf history. You know, I'm not saying like I'm a trivia whiz or anything, but like I've always been good at procuring things like artifacts that I have in the Golfus and information. This past week, I found I don't think it's ever been seen video of Charles Blair McDonald, which I just posted today, swinging in his prime. It was like 1897. And then H.J. Wiggum, who is his son-in-law, who won the... So between them, they won the first three U.S. amateurs. And I have their swings on video just through like going through different archives and things like
crazy.
That. I know. I get down rabbit holes all the time, and I'm 99% of the time I'm looking for something completely different, and then you discover something.
I can imagine you at Muirfield.
Oh, yeah.
Is just like eyes wide open.
It's amazing.
Smile from ear to ear.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. I've spent time at Muirfield, the Honorable Company of Edinburgh Golfers. It is, yeah. I mean, that I've been lucky enough this last year I went into the RNA clubhouse. I could live there. We were at Pine Valley some years ago. A member took me, and it was time for dinner, and everyone's sitting down. And they have this wonderful display of golf clubs that include quite a few numbers of Hugh Philp, the putter I showed you in there. And everyone was sitting down, and they were like, "Connor, you know, come eat." And I'm like, "I'll be there in a bit. I don't know how long it's going to take. I'll be there in a bit." And I just spent 20 minutes looking at the artifacts that they had in their collection. Then, you know, when I was leaving on my flight home, I wrote up, I don't know, maybe a 10-page, you know, document telling the history of each one of those clubs and estimating its value for the club. Because when we were sitting there, someone came up to ask if I enjoyed the collection. I said, "Do you guys know how much this is worth?" And they were like, "Not really. We've just been told if there's a fire, we need to take down this painting, save it." And I said, "The painting's great, save the painting, but save this stuff first." And I think there's a lot of stuff you see that at prominent clubs. We're familiar with the fire at Oakland Hills. And I've mentioned this before. I don't mean this as a slight whatsoever. You know, during that fire, there was a lot made of the firemen and firewomen saving the USGA trophies. And thank God they did, right? But my comment to that was trophies like that are kind of the last thing you want to save. Those are all replicas. They were not given to the club during the winning. It's not a historical U.S. Open trophy. It's a replica. Those are insured. The USGA will send you another one through your insurance claim. You know, save those things that cannot be replaced. And there's certain instances where it might be, what can you not replace? It's not necessarily the most expensive thing. It is what is irreplaceable. And so you take that away when you dive into golf history. Some things, you know, cost a lot of money but are very replaceable. And there's other things that cost very little bit of money but are priceless.
I want to take you to John Rattray.
Mm-hmm.
First Open champion.
Yeah. Strong argument for that. I've made it before, yeah.
And so learning about him,
mm-hmm.
what piqued your interest in him and then trying to learn about him?
I mean, I was pulled to him just through my love of Leith Links. I love all of the origin stories of Scotland. Rattray is fantastic because, you know, there's a trophy that sits on Leith Links now. Have you gone to Scotland before? Have you been to Leith Links?
I've not been there.
Not many people go. It's a lovely little park. I've made the argument that in 1744, when the first rules were written by the Honorable Company at Edinburgh Golfers, that first tournament was, you could argue, was the first open championship. It was an open competition to figure out who were the greatest golfers. John Rattray won it. Now, what's really interesting about him is he was a Jacobite. So he supported an usurper that was going to take down the king. And he was tried. He was going to be killed for it. And his friends stood up for his honor and saved his life. But what's really interesting is every likeness of him, every painting, what he looked like has been destroyed because all the Jacobites were wiped from golf. Well, not golf history, but just history. So today, if you go in the Honorable Company of Edinburgh Golfers Clubhouse, you see this blank place where his name is, but we have no image. Now, we also have this wonderful statue that sits on the Lethal Links that tells the story of Lethal Links and its importance to the game. I believe that its importance is much more than the 1744 rules, but perhaps the first Open Championship. And there is a statue of John hitting a golf ball, but we don't really know what he looked like. They just kind of took a guess. So I mean, I find that like mystery really fascinating. I love the tie-in to the first rules of the game. Mm-hmm. The Honorable Company of Edinburgh Golfers is really an amazing story in itself because they had every opportunity to become what is now the RNA. They were the leading voice. They wrote the first rules of golf. They threw the first Open. They were sucked into financial difficulties, which had them basically have to sell off everything they had. They had artwork that was lost that is priceless. They lost their clubhouse. They had to move to Musselburgh Links, which is another one of my favorite stories. Musselburgh, had to kind of like regain like control of their importance to the game of golf and resituate. Thank goodness they did, because they became, one of the owners of the Claret Jug in the long term. So, fortunately, they were not lost to history. There have been clubs that have been lost, and we were lucky that, they kind of regrouped, fixed their financials, and built themselves into the powerhouse they are today still.
Do you feel like that they will get back in the rotation mm-hmm. for an Open Championship?
I do. So I made an argument on Twitter that they probably have more power than they're willing to yield to get an Open, because technically they own 33% of the Claret Jug, as does Prestwick. So when young Tommy won the belt, the champion's belt, they had to build, they had that new trophy and they were going to have the new Open Rota, because Prestwick couldn't, really cover all the expenses, or didn't want to cover all the expenses. So they brought in the Honorable Company of Edinburgh Golfers, which was then at Musselburgh, and St. Andrews, the RNA, to help with the cost of this tremendous championship. And to my knowledge, they were never made whole for that investment, therefore own 33% of the Claret Jug. Now, I've had a member tell me that they feel that the actual Claret Jug, should travel between the three clubs because they are all one-third owners. There is a case, it's a dated one, in 1892, the Honorable Company of Edinburgh Golfers stole the Open Championship from Musselburgh. They gave them about 100 days notice. It was supposed to be played at Musselburgh. It was on a rota. It would have been, I believe, the seventh plane of the Open at Musselburgh, 1892. And the Honorable Company of Edinburgh Golfers had just built their course. It was designed by old Tom Morris. And they decided, we're taking the championship with us. And there were a couple, news stories in the articles. And the whole world blew up. That, you can't just pick up and open and do it. But they did it. So there might be precedents there that they could force the hand. Who knows? But I love the story that they're a third owner of essentially the Open Championship, or at least its trophy, yet are beholden to the RNA as to whether they go back to their championship venue.
This is Justin Akrey. If shoulder or elbow pain is affecting your daily life, the fellowship-trained physicians at the Orthopedic and Spine Hospital at UAMS Health are here to help. They offer advanced care for injuries, arthritis, rotator cuff problems, and more, helping you feel better, move better, and get back to everyday life. Call 501-686-TOSH today to schedule your appointment. That's 501-686-8674. The doctor will see you now.
We are about out of time for this edition of From the Shortgrass, presented by UAMS Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. I hope you enjoyed my sit-down with Connor Lewis. Now, part two will come your way in our next episode next week. You are not going to want to miss it. There is some deep dives into golf history and some artifacts that he has in his golfist that we will discuss in our next episode. Find us anywhere you get your podcast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. You can stream the shows directly via Spotify. And also we are on YouTube, From the Shortgrass, right there on YouTube. Want to thank our title sponsor, UAMS Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, for being with us all along the way. Remember, when you find your ball mark on the green, fix it and a couple of more. And I hope to see you sometime soon from the Shortgrass.
You have been listening to From the Shortgrass, presented by UAMS Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, a weekly podcast dedicated to the game of golf. This has been a presentation of the Buzz Radio Network in association with Majestic Cubby Productions.